You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable, where we get you up to date on all the things that made news this week. Joining me live in studio are Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Press, Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television, and joining us live on the phone from the Idaho State House is Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hello.
Okay, there's a lot to get to. Kevin, we want to start with you. I want you to set the scene as to where you're at right now at the State House, and then we will get to the reason as to why.
Right. So I'm standing on the second floor of the State House, down the hall from Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan's office. The office door is locked. She is evidently still in that office. You've got several reporters, other reporters who are sitting outside the office on stakeout. You have Boise State Public Radio's own James Dawson. You have a couple of reporters from the Idaho Press. So, Scott, you've got this covered.
Yep.
We're just kind of waiting. There's been no word from Lieutenant Governor McGeehan, and like I say, the doors are locked to her office right now.
Doors are locked and the lights are off, but she's still in there. So, Scott, tell us exactly as to why there is this media stakeout in front of the Lieutenant Governor's office, because this is not business as usual.
Right. So yesterday, Idaho Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan posted a photo on her Facebook page of herself posing with a couple of gentlemen who are in orange jail jumpsuits with the name Engel, E-N-G-E-L, on it. And they are flashing the 3% sign, and which is a reference to the 3% group, kind of a pro-gun rights organization. And McGeehan is using her hands to form a heart, and the caption says, "Sending love to Todd Engel." So Todd Engel is a gentleman who is currently in federal prison serving a 14-year sentence for obstruction of justice and interstate travel in aid of extortion in association with the 2014 Bunkerville standoff. So this is kind of the original Clive and Bundy standoff with the Bureau of Land Management over grazing rights and fees that he was ordered to pay by the Bureau of Land Management and the court system. He refused to pay it. The Bureau of Land Management began to impound his cattle, and a number of people felt that this was federal government overreach and showed up to defend Clive and Bundy. And some of these folks were armed and ready for an armed standoff with federal agents. One of those people was Todd Engel, who, according to prosecutors, had a loaded AR-15 rifle, and he was hiding behind a jersey barrier, concrete barrier, and pointing the weapon at federal law enforcement officers. So he was tried on those charges, and he was convicted in April of 2017, and he was sentenced last year to 14 years in prison. Mm-hmm. Now, since then, there's a little bit of a movement to free Todd Engel. There's a hashtag out there, Free Todd Engel, and a Facebook page calling Todd Engel a political prisoner. And the Facebook page is called Todd Engel Political Prisoner. And that photo of Janice McGeehan with the two gentlemen is at the top of that Facebook page. And so you can imagine that there's outcry over this, that the Idaho Lieutenant Governor is supporting Todd Engel, who was convicted of these crimes and is in federal prison for what he did.
And Bill, talk to us about back during the debate season when then-candidate Janice McGeehan was coming for a debate at Idaho Public Television, and because there was a kind of a whole, like, uproar about about this as well.
In fact, it even predates the November the election. I was just looking back today. There were stories in July going back talking about Janice McGeehan's controversial Facebook social media posts and photos of her in relationships, in political relationships with three percenters and militia types. So this is not a new issue involving our new lieutenant governor. When we had the debates in the fall, she showed up at Idaho Public Television with a security team. The suspicion was that they were armed. It wasn't clear if they were armed or not. There were no weapons shown, but there was also some connection to the three percenters. So this is not a new issue. I think you know, that iconic photo of Engel aiming his rifle behind that Jersey mm-hmm. barrier kind of represents is a brutal representation of that standoff at Bundy. And I don't think anyone excuses what he did. But I do think there are people who think he's being mistreated, and she falls into that camp. What interests me about this is that this is not new for the lieutenant governor, and I think we in the media are shocked by it, are reacting to it. I think the Democrats are shocked and reacting to it. I'm not sure the average voter in Idaho is going to be surprised that this is where her sympathies lie.
What about this idea within that picture when the two people who are making the supposed 3%er sign, there is debate, though, that is also a white power sign. So then we go into this whole idea of racism.
Yeah, and I don't know the connection. I mean,
right.
it's a very similar symbol, and, you know, I don't know if there is an intentional connection between the two. But, yes, it does look like that white power sign that people have been mm-hmm. talking about.
Yeah, I don't know either. Even if we stipulate that there's some white supremacist connection in that photo, I'm still not sure this is going to be a defining moment for McGee. And here's what I think is the issue: is her success as lieutenant governor depends on her relationship with the governor.
Mm-hmm.
Brad Little is a cautious, inclusive politician. And, you know, his success as lieutenant governor was the trust he had with Butch Otter. So is Lieutenant Governor McGeehan going to have the trust of the governor to get a significant role as lieutenant governor? Because if all you do is preside over the Senate for three months of the year, that's a pretty boring job for the lieutenant governor. So there's already a question about what kind of relationship the two are going to have, and I'm not sure she's demonstrating the kind of judgment that's going to make the governor want to trust her with mm-hmm. sensitive jobs as lieutenant governor.
Go ahead, Kevin. You
know, Bill makes a really good point, and I'd maybe take it a step further. I think 2 months into Governor Little's time in office, this is maybe the first real test of his position and his demeanor as governor. I mean, this is sort of a crisis within Idaho Republican Party circles, and I think there are going to be a lot of folks who watch Idaho politics who are going to be very interested to hear what the governor has to say when he does speak on this matter. And obviously he's been there are a lot of media inquiries directed at Governor Little at this point, so what he says and how he approaches this is going to be a telling moment for him as well.
Yeah, and the Democrats have, you know, jumped on this right away and said that this we can't have this. This is just unacceptable. It'll be interesting to me as well to see how many Republican legislators, you know, because I know that there are a lot of Republican legislators who kind of hold their nose at this thing and go, man, not again. Can we have to go down this path again? Yeah, this is a stain on the Republican Party. This is not who we are. And so I think it'll be interesting to watch, too, to see if there are any Republican legislators who come out against this.
Mm-hmm. And we should be clear, not only has Lieutenant Governor McKeon not made a statement or talked to media, in fact, our own James Dawson, who is down at the State House right now, as Kevin mentioned, she walked by him yesterday, I believe, and asked for a statement and basically, you know, ignored his request. But we still haven't heard from the governor as well. So no one has come out and made any type of statement at this point.
Well, Kevin's right. This is a test not just for Lieutenant Governor McGeehan, but also for how the governor handles this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's going to be as important to watch as whatever. You know, she's going to go into political damage mode and hunker down, and she can probably do fine. But, you know, the legislators and the governor have to legislate. We're coming into the critical part of the session. They can't just lock the door and stay in the office. Right.
And speaking of which, there were so many other things that actually happened at the State House this week, and this is just something that has risen to this level of attention. In fact, it's gotten some national headlines today about this issue with Lieutenant Governor McGeehan. But, Kevin, I do want to switch gears and talk about some issues that are really affecting potentially kids here in Idaho. Let's start with what happened with immunizations this week.
Well, you had a couple of things happen on the legislative front and also some news coming from the Department of Health and Welfare. So let's start with the health and welfare news. The agency released new immunization numbers on Thursday, and these are some surprising numbers, and they're significant. The overall immunization rate for kindergarten, first and seventh grade students dropped a little bit. We're down to 86.5% immunization rate. What I found really interesting in the numbers was that the rate of students who are in school without a full battery of immunizations because their parents have opted out of at least one of those immunizations, that number has increased significantly over the past couple of years. Now you have about 5,600 students in those three grades who are in school on some sort of an opt-out provision. To put that number into perspective, that's more kindergartners, first graders, and seventh graders than you have in the entire Boise school district.
Wow.
That's more kindergarten, first, and seventh grade students than you have in the entire charter school network, in every charter school in the state. So it's a large number of students here that we're talking about. And that gives you a sense of how difficult it is for the state to try to get to a 90% immunization rate or a higher than 90% immunization rate, which is what the health experts say you need to stem the potential tide of an outbreak of a contagious disease such as measles.
We're continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable. My guest today, Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Press, Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television, and joining us live on the phone from the State House is Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News. And I want to talk about these proposals about sex education at the State House. And Bill, let's actually start with you, because take us back to last year when there was this whole idea about rewriting the sex education laws, how they stand right now.
Right. There was a young woman who was a teen mom who went to the legislature and said, look, I've learned from this experience. I was doing some research and I realized that our sex education statutes were written in 1970 and haven't changed. And she partnered with Julie Van Orden, a legislator from Eastern Idaho, and they proposed a rewrite of the bill, and it backfired. It didn't pass, and then Julie Van Orden ended up losing her race in Eastern Idaho. So I think it's demonstrated, despite what we would all imagine in 2019, that this is still a potent political issue with a lot of downside.
And so then, Kevin, take us to this last week with some of the proposals. With the main proposal that has been made regarding sex education?
Well, the bill that you have before the legislature right now would require parents to opt their kids into sex education. Right now, parents can opt out of sex ed. This would turn that on its ear, and it would turn it into an opt-in. And it becomes a debate about values to some degree. I mean, Barbara Ehart, the legislator from Idaho Falls, who's pushing for the opt-in, has said that she doesn't think that the sex ed curriculum that she's seeing taught in the schools aligns with Idaho values. One of the other legislators on the House Education Committee who was pushing for the bill on Friday said for a lot of Idahoans, the concept of sex is restricted solely to sex between a man and a woman who are married. And that's a value system that exists to a large degree in a lot of Idaho households. And, our policies should align with that or respect the fact that that's a viewpoint that's shared by a number of Idahoans. So anyway, the opt-in bill passed the House Education Committee this morning on a party line vote, and now it heads to the House floor.
And any idea of what may happen on the House floor? Have you heard anything about if this will potentially get to the governor's desk?
Well, if it's a party line issue on the House floor, obviously it's going to pass the House, and it probably do likewise in the Senate. I don't know where this goes from here, except that I think with a lot of these issues, a lot of these values issues that we've seen in these past couple of weeks of the legislature, whether it's opt-in on sex education or legislation to make it easier for parents to opt out of immunizations, to get opt-out information to parents on immunizations, to a bill allowing concealed weapons permit holders, enhanced concealed weapons permit holders to bring a gun into schools. This has become the year of the opt-in or the opt-out, or it's become the year of a variety of legislation on hot-button issues that are designed to sort of churn the tide towards individuals having the ability to, to exercise their right to not immunize their kids or,
Well, and again, it goes
out of sex education classes.
It becomes a local control issue again. Mm-hmm. You know, immunization, forcing school districts to do something that they might not want to do. Sex ed, the school districts, and the school boards are the ones who are approving the curriculum. And now the state is saying, well, that's not good enough for us. We want to, trump your authority on a local level.
And Scott, that's a good point. The guns in schools bill has a really powerful local control element to it, because right now school boards can allow employees or staff or teachers to carry guns in school. And several districts and charters are doing just that sort of a first line of defense as they see it. What this guns in schools bill would do is it would basically take the local school boards and the charter boards out of that equation. And anybody who has an enhanced concealed carry permit can carry a gun with no questions asked. So,
and without telling their school district. Yeah.
So Kevin,
it becomes a don't ask, don't tell policy as pertains to guns in school. That's why the Boise School District has come out against this and said, local school boards should have the right and the prerogative to make that decision.
Hey, Kevin, really quickly, tell us briefly what this this guns in schools issue is, because for people that don't follow the legislature as closely as we all do, they may not be fully aware.
So what the bill would do, and it was just introduced this week, is any adult who has an enhanced concealed weapons permit would be able to bring a gun into school with no questions asked. And that involves not just teachers or principals, it involves visitors. If you have an enhanced concealed carry license, you would be able to bring a gun into school. And one of the arguments against the bill is that if you're allowing guns in school, no questions asked, a principal wouldn't be able to ask a visitor or a staffer, are you carrying a weapon? Even in the middle of an incident, even if, God forbid you had an incident going on in school, a principal would not be able to ask and try to ascertain, who's armed and who isn't. So that was one of the concerns that came up in committee just in that first hearing. And if it comes back for a public hearing, I would expect that it's going to be a very divisive
issue. I think it would be a huge public hearing, Bill.
So what strikes me is we're seeing all these wedge issues emerge here at this critical moment in the legislature. Sex education, vaccinations, guns in schools. We had this anti-Muslim minister, preaching again this week. And so, contrast these really divisive wedge issues against, what Professor Moncrief and Samantha have explained to us is a really orderly process for getting the budget bills passed. And so it's almost like a tale of two legislatures. You have one group of people who are trying to drive this wedge into the body, and you have this other very orderly process happening. And so I contrast that against this presentation I went to yesterday in the Lincoln Auditorium where Professor Moss,
I spoke to, and I loved what his whole thing was. He talked to – yeah. So tell us about this.
So he gives this presentation in the Lincoln Auditorium last night that talks about how the framers at the very beginning of our country, in a time every bit as divided as the time we're in now, kind of write the Constitution to try to protect the minority – protect the power of the majority, but also not let us descend into this partisanship. And so what I took away from that presentation, and I'm thinking about what's going on upstairs above that auditorium in the legislature, is he's talking about how you have to have this what he called productive tension in order for the debate to happen and for everybody to have their say and to get to the best decisions, but you can't let it descend into this hyper-partisanship and rancor where then we break down and we don't protect democracy. So he said you have to have this tension, and you also have to have this love for democracy, and you find success and progress by marrying those two. So I think we're seeing in the very legislature this week those two forces at play, and where the session's going to go, I don't know.
Right. And to get back to this guns in schools, you know, so Kevin, you said the Boise School District has come out against this. Have other districts, what have they made any public statements about this? Because, I mean, as a parent with children in school, I think of all of the adults that come into even my children's school as volunteers and things like that. And you think about the fact that you can't ask. I mean, well, as a parent, that is just mind-blowing.
Well, the School Boards Association, which represents school trustees from across the state, they've indicated that they will probably oppose this bill. We'll see what we hear. We'll see what happens if this goes to a full public hearing. Mm-hmm. Whether school officials on the local level speak on this thing. I can just tell you that from the print hearing that we had on Tuesday, where there was no public testimony, you had a number of folks from Every Town for Gun Safety in attendance. They were wearing their red T-shirts advocating for gun control. You had a few members of the Three Percenters in the room as well with their shirts and hoodies. So you could just by looking at the room, you could tell that this is going to be a wedge issue and a divisive hearing if it gets to a full hearing. And that has not been scheduled yet, but we'll obviously keep a close eye out.
Scott, another thing that we have been talking about quite a bit here on Idaho Matters is the first responder bill. And we just had Representative Matt Erpelding on earlier, I believe last week, talking about the progress it has made. And you've got an update for us.
Yeah, it passed the House. So this is a bill that would allow first responders to use PTSD as a workers' compensation claim. And without having some sort of physical injury, that it was only allowed before if you had some sort of physical injury, you could also claim workers' comp for PTSD. So the bill would allow first responders to use PTSD as a workers' compensation claim, and it passed the House and now goes to the governor for a signature.
And I want to bring it down to the city level. So, Bill, a little bit of a smackdown that happened. Is that a good word when we talk about urban renewal?
I think what's interesting is this: not only is there tension inside the legislature, there's tension between rural legislators and conservative legislators, and the great state of Ada, and you know, and King Beater in Boise, and so. You have a group of legislators led by Mike Moyle proposing that if the city wants to spend urban renewal money for its library or its stadium, they'll have to take that to a vote of the people. And that is anathema to city leaders who think they should have the power to make those decisions. And not only do they – it's up to them whether to seek a vote, but it's not the legislators' purview to tell them how to spend their money. That goes to the very heart of this conflict we have in Idaho over state versus city powers. Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's interesting to note, it's not just Mike Moyle. Representatives Rick Youngblood and Bob Anderst are involved in this as well, and they're from Nampa. And so Nampa, of course, built a police station, a parking garage, a library using urban renewal. And Anderst and Youngblood come from the perspective of like, geez, these big, huge projects got built and we're still saddled with paying those off without a public vote. And so they see the same thing happening in Boise. And, you know, when you talk about local control, sure, it takes some of the local control out of the city council, but doesn't it give more control to the voters, the people, to vote on an $85 million or $100 million library project? So that's kind of the perspective that I think Youngblood and Anders are coming from.
I mean, Idaho has had this fundamental debate as long as I've been in the state over of local authority, and is a state going to give the city local taxing authority so they can make these decisions? And I don't think we're going to get any resolution on that.
Mm-hmm. And Scott, want to end with you, Canyon County Commissioners, they had a mandate.
Yeah, this is interesting. This all started back in the election. We found out, our reporter, Nicole Foy, found out that elections workers were told that they cannot communicate with a voter who comes in speaking Spanish. Even if they can speak Spanish with them, they were told that there is a prohibition. We asked about that, and they said, well, it's a state law. And so we said, where is that state law? And, well, there really isn't one.
We don't know.
So they, after we inquired about it, they got rid of that rule on the elections office. Well, then come to find out that there was a county ordinance passed in 2006 by Robert Vasquez and David Ferdinand, who voted that all business must be conducted in English only. And so it was basically a prohibition against speaking anything other than English. And so we started writing about it, and we found out that in 2013, the county's own attorneys had told the commissioners that this ordinance was constitutionally infirm or sick and was really actually inefficient. So there were county employees who said, this is just inefficient for us. Mm-hmm. If I have an employee who can speak Spanish, let's get it taken care of and let's help our constituents, who are coming in for help. So this week on Monday, the Canyon County Commissioners voted to finally rescind that law. Even in 2013, when they found out that it was constitutionally wrong, they didn't rescind it. They just kept it on the books and just said, okay, well, just let everybody know that that's no good. But this week they finally took action and finally got rid of that ordinance.
There was a lot that happened this week.
Busy week.
Busy, busy week.
And it's only noon.
Right? I know.
And just to cut in, door is still locked. Still no Janice McGee. Fighting, stakeout continues.
And it may through the weekend, you know?
Who knows?
She's got to go home at some point. I mean, I don't think there's a back entrance from her office.
I think there's a Saturday Night Live skit in this.
Somewhere there will be. I want to thank you guys for coming in. You always make Fridays great. My guest, Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Press, Kevin Richard at the State House with Idaho Education News, and Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television. Good to always have you guys here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.